and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Does Donald Trump have a different and new grand strategy for American foreign policy, a policy approach that is a departure from the past? If so, then what can we and the world expect? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He is an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Mark in here in Moscow. You know, Mark, this program is about what kind of vision Donald Trump may or may not have, a grand strategy for American foreign policy. As everyone is aware, there's a lot of things going on in the world, and Trump is, even before becoming president in the last few weeks, have made some interesting proclamations about what he will or will not do. But I'm going to be unorthodox here and start it kind of in reverse. Mark, it's widely said that whoever the American people vote for, they get John McCain. Do we have John McCain coming into office?
I actually would say no. There may be an attempt by the neocon, and when I say that, I use it in the shall we say, the modern bipartisan sense of the word. It's no longer truly conservative. But those committed to U.S. hegemony and primacy around the world, they may try to manipulate Trump, as they quite openly and clearly did so, according to John Bolton's memoirs, manipulate him back into that position. But I don't think that he sees international relations and geopolitics through that prism. In fact, I think he, whatever we may think about his conclusions and solutions, I think he's correctly identified the problem is that the U.S. is suffering from an enormous amount of, we might have previously said, imperial overreach. Now we might say hegemonic overreach. It can no longer afford to be the, what it calls, the policeman of the world or the military dictator of the world. And it needs to prioritize and come to grips with a world of rising great powers. Now, Trump's solutions to that is another question entirely, but I think he's correctly identified the problem that the pursuit of hegemony and the benefits of it, the costs far outweigh the benefits to the United States today. So him and those around him have correctly identified that problem. The next question is, what is Donald Trump's vision and solution?
Yeah, I mean, I think George, Mark really centers on the most important point, hegemony. And it's really basically how to maintain it. Now, we've had in the past, we've had this liberal order that has been used as an ideological cover. And what we've seen over the last few weeks for the incoming president is, you know, refreshingly a little bit of realism. But realism can be used towards maintaining hegemony as well. I mean, it's the same thing. It's just dressed up in a different way. George?
No, I think so. And I think that's why it's so difficult, really, to get a handle on what's likely to come from the Trump administration. Trump really sees his next 4 years as a kind of civilizational renewal. I mean, he's going for broke. He wants to really make his mark on the world. And he wants America to get back to some vague idea of what it was. So he really, this is very important for him to think that somehow America, there'll be a kind of cultural renewal of America. That's why it was significant that he appointed these three kind of elderly Hollywood stars as his emissaries to Hollywood, because I think he sees that as part of his civilizational rejuvenation. And part of that, I think, is his notion of going back to some idea of what America was before it embarked on World War II, before it embarked on this all the Cold War, its global alliances. And that's why I think he's looking warily at particularly the post-Cold War era of really this globalism, entangling alliances, creating this this liberal world order, rules based order, policing the world, and essentially getting entangled with in every single country's internal affairs. So it's this, whatever happens anywhere is somehow a crisis for the United States. He wants to get away from that and just simply focus on what is important for the United States. The problem is that it's easier said than done. And other presidents have also thought about that. And, all the way back to Richard Nixon. And, we have to just focus on what's important for us. You can't just simply, dissipate our energy on pointless conflict. So I think it's going to be a challenge. And I think, as Mark points out, he's surrounded himself with many would-be neocons, interventionists, McCainiacs, who are determined to continue as before.
Yeah, well, Mark, the argument would be made, and it will be made against Trump in a matter of months, days, maybe hours after he takes office, is that, well, there's a certain way of doing business, and presidents, well, they come and go, but we have an established approach to governing the world through hegemony. We've seen this movie before. Trump did try the pulling out of troops from Syria, the easiest example, or making a bold overture to North Korea. We all know how these things ended. Why is it going to be different this time?
Okay, so first of all, let's address a interesting point that George brought up about Trump's diplomatic, shall we say, sensibilities. Sending Mel Gibson to be the diplomat to the rest of Hollywood, that either indicates that Trump's diplomatic sensibilities are very poor, or that he's throwing Hollywood the collective big middle finger, which I think is probably closer. He's effectively trolling Hollywood and letting them know who's in charge. I think that's more to the point. George also made a good point that dovetails into what you asked, is that previous presidents, although not quite in the same way, have also previously, within living memory, committed to a kind of reprioritization of the United States over its foreign policy entanglements. George W. Bush promised the same thing. And then his administration immediately said about trying to remake the Middle East. Bill Clinton did the same thing and then ended up beginning the carving up of Serbia in the middle of Europe, as well as getting entangled elsewhere around the world. So there is an orthodoxy of foreign policy, right? And this is, clearly decided on, Ben Rhodes called it the blob. You can call it the deep state. You can call it the permanent bureaucracy. But these are the real people that decide U.S. foreign and military policy. And they are not elected and they don't go away, certainly not very easily. Victoria Nuland is no longer part of the administration, but she is almost certainly a key constituent part of the blob. And her husband, Kagan, just reminded us of that with an article decrying Trump's position on Ukraine going forward. So I think that actually this is probably going to consume a great deal of the Trump presidency of the next few years as he tries to buck that foreign policy orthodoxy, that deep state. They are going to resist. They are going to try to manipulate him. And if manipulation fails, it will become outright warfare. And we saw what happened to the last president who promised to scatter the CIA to the winds. He's, shall we say, quickly exited the presidential scene. So I've often described Trump as a chaos bomb, and it's all a kind of like a bouncing Betsy one that goes in multiple different directions. And right now, it looks like that chaos bomb is going off, one, on the transatlantic relationship with threats about annexing Greenland and Canada and retaking the Panama Canal, that more an effect on South American relations per se, but also inside the Beltway. And I think that's where Trump's real fight, where his real conflict of his administration may end up, is in D.C. as he attempts to take on the blob. And that is going to be a rough ride for, well, Trump, everyone but outside powers may well decide to see that that is a point that they can take advantage of and exploit the situation.
So, George, where are you putting your money, on the blob or Trump?
Well, history would suggest that the blob will prevail. Trump, so far, he got off to a reasonable start. He weighed in on the Middle East. He applied pressure on Netanyahu, and he demonstrated to everybody that the previous administration could have done far more than it actually did to restrain Israel. And that is a hopeful sign, because, you know, if we look back on history, actually, Republicans have been the only ones who have actually ever applied any pressure against Israel, you know, going all the way back, of course, to Eisenhower himself, you know, bludgeoning Israel to withdraw from Sinai. We know about Reagan getting on the phone to Menachem Begin, you know, telling him to knock it off. Even the hapless George W. Bush said at one point that enough is enough, and put forward his famous roadmap that eventually led to kind of a serious peace negotiation, the Olmert peace plan. So, you know, Trump is actually, you know, following in the tradition of Republicans who have actually, you know, applied some pressure on Israel. And Trump demonstrated, well, he can do it. The question is, will he persist with this? Because he is going to come under a great deal of pressure, and it's already being applied against him, you know, to knock it off. Same thing will happen with Ukraine. He's clearly outlining some kind of a vision of bringing this thing to an end. Now, there's an awful lot of steps along the way, and there will definitely be an enormous effort, both in Washington, in Brussels, in London, to thwart any attempt on Trump's part to bring this the war in Ukraine to an end.
Well, I want to talk about Ukraine in the second half of the program, but Mark, it is possible that peace feelers, a plan will be put out, but it's all a smokescreen because they know they can't end it, and they're going just to double down. That's what, those of you that say, you know, the last legs, it's almost over, you're all wrong. And my guests here are going to make that point when we come back from our break. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we're discussing some real news. Mark, I at the very end of the first part of the program, I mentioned Ukraine. And obviously, George has already pointed out that before he even becomes president, Donald Trump has made his will known. Let's put it that way. At least that's what media reports tell us about what's going on in Palestine, Israel. I'm still a skeptic about this. I think we're in the middle of something. It's not the end of anything. It may be the end of the beginning, but this is a picture. This is a situation that is far more complex. It's easy. Just take a win. I got a win. Okay. That's what public relations is all about. And we all know that Trump is interested in only wins, however that is defined. But I want to go, Mark, I want to go back to Ukraine. Well, we've seen, the benchmarks moving out now from 24 hours has got to be taken care of in Ukraine before the inauguration. Now it's 100 days, it's 6 months, kind of echoing what we said in the first part of the program. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to express my skepticism. The foreign policy blob, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, they're not going to give him a win here. Mark.
Yeah, first of all, I was just going to ask, beg me for being permission to be a cynic and a skeptic on Trump suddenly bringing peace to the Middle East. We don't, of course, don't know what kind of leverage, what kind of carrots and sticks he's
what kind of quid pro quo is out there.
Yes. Yeah, we don't know what the story is, but if anyone thinks that Netanyahu is cowed and is suddenly going to curl over and show his stomach to Donald Trump, I very much have doubts whether this ceasefire will last 24 hours or, you know, at least a couple of days into Trump's administration. And there's already signs, you know, coming from the Netanyahu administration that, you know, I haven't seen that they've actually ceased airstrikes on Gaza. Let's put it that way. But, you know, at least he made an attempt and made his will known, as you said. As to Ukraine, yeah, there's so much impetus behind this. And there's no question that Trump, one, doesn't like the Kiev regime's leadership, you know, either the previous one or this one. He regards them as his domestic political enemies in the United States because of the way they quite stupidly and heavy-handedly wade into U.S. domestic politics on the issue. And then the clumsy attempts to manipulate him afterwards were transparent, even, I think, to Trump. And he certainly thinks it's a not in U.S.'s, shall we say, red line strategic interests. He thinks it's a waste of money. He also has nothing but contempt for the majority of Western political leaders in Europe who are the biggest, you know, crusaders in this particular measure. And that brings up, you know, the obstacles to this. One of them has already been launched by one of Trump's political enemies, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Keir Starmer, who evidently sent political operatives to the United States to campaign effectively for Joe Biden. Really dumb move there. But he was just in Kiev and signing a largely rhetorical and substanceless 100-year commitment security guarantee to Ukraine that really doesn't actually say much at all. He's attempting to, one, continue the Western process of, you know, lifting his leg and urinating on Kiev as Western geopolitical territory. But it's also a direct shot at the Trump administration. You think you're going to pull out of this? I don't think so. So this is definitely intended as an obstacle. You know, of course, a signal to Russia, but also a signal to the Trump administration. And these Western political leaders, they are committed to this conflict. And they are very upset. They were upset during the first Trump administration. They expressed joy at the return of the hegemon to form under Joe Biden. And they are furious at being put in the same position again. They believe in U.S.-led Western global hegemony more than the U.S. president does. And they're going to try to rope him back into the Ukraine conflict, whatever he may think about it or not.
You know, Jim, Mark brings up such an excellent point. When it comes to Ukraine, Trump is going to be battling America's alliance partners and the Beltway. And where the negotiations come in with the Russians, that's way down there. I mean, it's actually low priority because he has to get through this entangling alliance system that is, you know, and we've all talked about how that is so counterproductive to the national interests of all members of this alliance, not just the United States. And Trump is going to have to battle a bipartisan commitment in Congress, and let alone the intransience that he's going to have in the Defense Department, the State Department, etc. I mean, this battle is far more complex than mainstream left or right media is presenting it. George?
No, I think it's going to be extremely difficult. And then you have to then ask, well, how far is Trump prepared to confront the bureaucracy and to confront his NATO allies? Now, you've got these NATO people, Macron and the rest of them, who are eager to send in European forces into Ukraine. Now, you know, this is all, of course, nonsensical because Trump himself knows that, well, if you're going to send in European forces, that's just a mechanism for drawing us in. Because if you get shot at, then you're going to come begging to us and say, oh, help us out. And in any case, even the whole idea of deploying European forces, it requires American logistics, American airlift. I mean, they're not going to be able to do it themselves. So Trump knows that this is a really poison chalice that the Europeans are offering. Oh, well, you don't have to do it. You know, we'll do it. So what I think is likely to happen, I think, Trump, and then, you know, and Marco Rubio suggested this, and others have suggested he's going to offer some version of Minsk III. Let's freeze the conflict, you know, we'll put off NATO membership and talk about NATO membership into the indefinite future, and then maybe we can talk about some kind of partial sanctions relief, you know, just to sweeten the pot a little bit. I don't think it's going to work. I mean, I think this is, I don't think there's anything here for the Russians. I don't think there's anything, even Ukraine doesn't see this as in any way beneficial. The Europeans are going to resist. And then I think after a few months, I think this will drag on for a few months. I think Trump will have to then decide, well, what do I do now? And I think that's the moment that the pressure will arise and say, well, you need to escalate. You know, you really need to show Putin, who's the boss? You really need to show that somehow, that because that's the only way you can get Putin to the negotiating table. You're not going to get him there by offering him sanctions relief and sweetening the pot. You've got to really get tough with him. And I have to believe Trump will go down that path.
Unfortunately, I have to agree. But Mark, given what George just said, which is absolutely spot on in my opinion here, yep. The next few months is going to be a discussion and a dialogue, a monologue among Western stakeholders in all of this. We haven't even mentioned, we know what the Russian position is. It's been made clear over and over and over again. I can, and that's is a point of the start negotiations, but we're not even there. We're not even there right now. It's going to be Trump against the NATO countries, members of the leadership in Europe, and the people that are going to thwart him, like they did in his first administration. I think George is right. Escalation is virtually inevitable.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that George is spot on, Russia, you know, will have discussions with the Trump administration, certainly. And it's very likely that, from what we've heard, that Trump will actually want to meet with Putin, and they'll talk and they'll say, you know, hey, it's really nice that we can sit down and actually talk to each other again. There's a lot of things in the world we need to discuss and have dialogue on. But as for your proposals, you know, for Ukraine, you're on the losing side of this conflict. We detect that we direct the terms, not you, right? And if you're not willing to agree to our terms, which we've made clear, you can continue to talk amongst yourselves all you want. But meanwhile, we're going to continue, creating facts on the ground, on the battlefield, which we're doing increasingly. And so the cries will be in Washington to escalate, to de-escalate, to show strength, right? And that's how they will try to manipulate and rope him into it. Both the European leaders within his own, the neocons in his own administration, of which there is a plethora, and the rest of the blob, and the beltway. And that will be the crux moment. How does Trump respond? There'll be two of them. One, when Putin says, "Niet, thanks, but no thanks." And the second one will come further down the road. Probably, maybe considerably further down the road, but in a year or two, when Russian troops are crossing the Dnieper and moving on Kiev, right? And both of them will be huge crux moments.
So, George, as this monologue, discussion, debate, et cetera, will go on week after week, month after month, because they're putting the goalposts further out, Ukraine gets weaker and smaller. So, I mean, what are they negotiating for?
No, well, that's right. It's the cynical policy that's been initiated by the United States, which is, well, we're going to weaken Russia. We're going to bleed Russia. We're going to injure Russia. We're going to impoverish Russia. But by doing so, you're doing it at the expense of Ukraine. And the American policy, NATO policy, well, so what? I mean, you know, the Ukraine is expendable. The problem with this escalate to de-escalate policy is that it's never ending. That's it. Once you go down that path, that means the war goes on forever. Because, of course, the moment, it seems as if, hey, well, you know, maybe we can now sit down and negotiate. We're in a stronger position. So, well, no, because, you know, that was because we got tough with Russia. That's why we're in a stronger position. That means we need to escalate even more, and then we'll be in an even better position. So that's it. That's the road for, you know, endless war. And this has been the policy of the Biden administration. And you have to believe that, you know, Trump will continue with this. The kind of boldness of vision that you would need really to take this thing by the scruff of the neck and just bring it to an end. I don't see this in Trump. I just there's nothing in the past that would suggest that he would expend that kind of energy and to withstand the attacks that would come against him, including, you know, impeachment, possible assassination, everything. I just don't see Trump doing this.
Well,
he'll make the effort. But I don't see that he will persist with this.
All the more so is that he has other things he wants to do.
Exactly.
Mark, give me the last minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that brings us what he wants to do, his grand strategy vision. And it may actually not be much better for Americans or the rest of the world than hegemony primacy. Taking a look at what he said about Greenland and Canada and Panama, what he's talking about is most likely, it appears, old school imperialism, right? You know, maybe with a realist element of great powers and spheres of influence. But, you know, you want to call it the Monroe Doctrine? We can call it the Donroe Doctrine, right? I mean, that's the Western Hemisphere is mine. I may not care about anything else. There has been surprisingly little objection from the New York Times into the Washington Post to Trump's suggestion that the U.S. takes control of Greenland, where it already has military bases, by one way or another. That's pretty amazing.
Well, Mark, let me ask you real quick, because these are like easy wins. Is this part of the calculus that, you know, they go, I got Panama, I got Canada, and what about the Middle East? Well, what about Ukraine? Well, what about China? Well, okay. That's the way I kind of look at it. All right, gentlemen, we've rapidly run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.